The Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee will come to order. Members, we have a full day. I just wanted to make a quick announcement that in terms of our schedule, if you are planning on bringing any bills before this committee on guns, that we will start our hearings February 5th, 6th, and maybe into the 7th of our committee days. That is our tentative schedule. I'm not sure how many bills will be heard. I thought we could hear them all, but if there's too many, we may have to figure something out. So just wanted to alert people who had. And then it looks like the tour is when? Oh, okay. With that, we have a full day here. Today we're going to be talking about sexual violence, civil commitment. And this important committee, important issue for this committee, every year there's bills that are introduced increasing sentencing for sex offenders. Unfortunately, I was in this body when the Drew Shadeen case happened, and it changed policy-wise what we are now doing with sex offenders and the MSOP program, and it's a significant problem. This committee will not address that in and of itself, but with other committees, we are going to have to look at that entire system in terms of its cost and constitutionality. This committee, however, will be looking at the lack of treatment for sex offenders, the fact that hundreds of sex offenders are released every year into our communities, except for level 3 sex offenders, and a whole issue around prevention that we don't talk about very often that I am hoping we can get to today. So what we are going to do is we're going to hear a presentation from Min Casa, and then Dean Janice from William Mitchell is going to address the body, and then we'll have an overview of the whole civil commitment process, which is sometimes complicated. So with that, Donna Dunn, Executive Director of Min Casa, thank you for coming on short notice, and I'll just turn it over to you if you could just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pleased to be here. My name is Donna Dunn, and we're very glad to have the opportunity to address you and to the members of the committee about this very important issue that affects so many Minnesotans. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and with me today is our public policy consultant, Bob Tracy.
Thank you, Donna. And as Donna indicated, my name is Bob Tracy. I'm a public policy consultant from Min Casa. And before we jump into our presentation today, which will take us probably about 15 minutes, I'm just reflecting upon the fact that it was almost 6 years ago to the day that I started working with Min Casa. I had not worked in the field of sexual violence, certainly not with the great experience that Donna brings to this work. But as part of that initial effort, took some time driving around southeastern Minnesota visiting some of our programs. And what I found in those conversations were sexual assault advocates who had a very strong commitment to working with victims and survivors through the process of recovering from an assault. They had a strong belief in having a responsive criminal justice system, a supportive medical system, police, and others to help assure that victims had access to justice. But I'm prompted in those conversations by each of the individuals was a frustration with structural barriers to having a balanced response to sexual violence, one that included prevention. And so much of the presentation you hear today is going to address that. I might also add that the presentation you're going to see today included a video. And we had to make a computer switch up here, so that component's not going to be working. But we did have a backup plan, and if the chair is willing, Donna and I were going to do an interpretive dance of the video component.
We're looking forward.
I'll let you know when that happens. By way of overview, the key points that my job in this presentation is to guide you through the presentation, and Donna will be providing more of the substantive comments. But the key points in this presentation are first to talk about the importance of having a balanced approach to stopping the harm of sexual violence. What we've learned through the years, especially through the last 7 or 8 years, is the importance, the growing importance of having a data-driven response to sexual violence. We also, as part of those that learning process, appreciate that if we're going to have a long-term impact in reducing the impact of sexual violence in our communities, prevention needs to be one of our priorities. And finally, that sexual violence is a complex issue. We all fully appreciate that. But it means that our policy response, our service responses require multifaceted and coordinated responses. I hope that at the end of this presentation, one of the things you carry away from what we're sharing with you today is an understanding that the work that you do as legislators to address sexual violence doesn't just happen sitting around this table in this committee. But because of the multifaceted nature of sexual violence, it's the work that you do when you go to an education committee, when you go to a health and human service committee, when you do your work on a housing committee, when you look at higher education, even state and local government. Issues of sexual violence, and particularly preventing sexual violence, are going to be on the table in those committees as well. They may not have the word sexual violence in them, but all of the factors that come together to create this harm in our communities are addressed in those committees as well. So your work as a legislator to address sexual violence certainly happens on this committee, but I hope that you'll take it into your other legislative work as well. The presentation we have today is largely chronological. We're looking back over the last 7 or 8 years at work that's been done in Minnesota to help create a more balanced response to sexual violence and the harm it does in our communities. Things started back in 2005-2006 with some work that MnCASA did, inviting professionals from the Prevention Institute based in California, recognized as national leaders on public health prevention, to come and provide training for sexual assault advocates throughout Minnesota and other advocates to understand what a prevention framework for responding to sexual violence would look like. That framework is presented here on this slide, but oftentimes we think about prevention as starting at the bottom of this slide, of this rainbow presentation here, as strengthening individual skills, knowledge, helping people develop the capacity to keep themselves safe. That's certainly part of it, but if you move to the top of this image, the red box, it also means that we have to address policies and environmental factors, but especially policies that create an environment that fosters sexual violence. Donna, excuse me, you may want to comment on the impact of that training.
One second. Mr. Tracy, you didn't provide copies of the PowerPoint. I can't see it personally, so I mean, when you're going over it, maybe you could say what some of the words are. It's just my eyes, but others may not have that problem. So
certainly, Mr. Chair, and I can tell you I'm having that problem here.
Okay.
You did receive the handout that you received in your packets today. While it's not the slide set, it does include much of the content of the slides. This image is not on that. Okay. And I will give you a sense, though, of what's in this spectrum of prevention. So if you look at the bottom of the image, the piece in purple, it's strengthening individual knowledge and skills. We've done this in the past by giving people whistles so they can be safe in a parking lot, but a number of other things. Moving up from there, the blue boxes that we promote community education. So things that we do to promote awareness, we go out and do presentations at community groups. We educate and we train providers so that they're skilled in responding and helping partners in the community deal with sexual violence issues. The part that we don't often think about, though, and this gets into the yellow box, is we really need to do the work in coalitions and networks. And so you'll see a lot of what MnCASA has been doing over the past 6 or 7 years has been about bringing together coalitions, networks, partners who we don't normally think of being involved with sexual violence work. The harder things start to get to look at organizational practices. For example, working with businesses to help them have sexual violence policies within their workplace that go beyond what the law might require around sexual harassment. And then finally, looking at policies and legislative responses that change the environment in which we live. Some of those may be the decisions we make around whether or not sexual violence prevention is going to be a legislative priority. But, and you'll see in some of our work in the past, it's been things like we had a conversation a couple of years ago about quote-unquote clean hotels and whether or not the state should be purchasing services from hotel providers that also offer pay-per-view pornography within their environments. That's a policy change that helps to change and counter the environment that fosters sexual violence. So that's what's on the chart there.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Dunn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just to elucidate a little bit on what Bob has said, when we look at the spectrum of prevention, and when we trained on it with the Prevention Institute and brought our Rape Crisis Center advocates together, it was really an opportunity to examine how we had been addressing prevention. And we had often really been stuck at that lower level of the spectrum, just working with communities to understand for women and children, how you can be safe, how you can tell if something happens to you, which are not unimportant things to do. But we often found that our work stopped there, or raising awareness about the prevalence of sexual violence and child sexual abuse. So what we were able to do is really take a look at this whole spectrum and say, how do we adopt a public health approach to stopping this issue? How do we not only do those things, but how do we work at all levels of the spectrum? Because that's where we are more likely to get change that is sustainable, that continues, and that really address the root causes of sexual violence. And so the impact of this shift in thinking was really critical for those of us who are working in the rape crisis response movement and who have a commitment to prevention. What we were hearing from advocates is, I'm so tired, and from law enforcement and prosecutors, I'm so tired of seeing the same story over and over and over again. What can we do to make sustainable change?
2007 was an important point in advancing the conversation about sexual violence and how we make prevention one of our interests. The Department of Health released the Cost of Sexual Violence report. The report, first of all, provided an estimate of the prevalence of sexual violence in Minnesota. I know a couple of years ago, walking the hallways here at the legislature, almost everyone could tell me how many people were being treated through the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. But one number that we don't often have at the tip of our tongues is the prevalence of how many people are victimized each year. And our policies shift if we understand that number and we have that in the front of our minds. The estimate in the Cost of Sexual Violence report was 61,000 individual Minnesotans every year affected by sexual violence. The report went on to estimate the total economic impact on the state of $8 billion annually. It also pointed out sort of the imbalance in our response, the fact being that we put $0, zero state general fund dollars into primary prevention, but we have our greatest expenses occurring in perpetrator incarceration or treatment and victim medical care and support. But the three sort of big numbers that we carried away from that report were 61,000 individuals victimized annually, an $8 billion annual economic impact on the state, and zero public dollars at the state level invested in primary prevention.
If I could say in response to that also, what this report did was really it did shine a light on what the reality of sexual violence and the impact of sexual violence in Minnesota was. We've been hard pressed to get good data and to get our hands on the numbers that help us understand the scope of this issue in Minnesota, and this was one of the first really important tools to do that. It did help us understand that what we are looking at our state and in other states is that this is an endemic issue, that we have a normal rate of sexual assault that's happening, of sexual violence that's happening, that we have assumed to be normal, which means that unless we make a commitment to changing that, we will continue to see a rate of sexual violence that affects as many as 61,000 Minnesotans in a year. That's a norm that we don't want to continue to support.
And as you know, we have about 10 more minutes in our presentation. Okay. also, the image of the Metro Dome here is not a nostalgic reflection on what soon will not be, but rather illustrates the fact that there are enough sexual assault incidents in this state to fill the Metro Dome each year. We looked ahead in 2008. MnCASA reached out with members of the legislature. We created the Legislative Caucus to Prevent Sexual Violence. We also started work on creating public awareness about the impact of prevention in our response to sexual violence. And in co-partnership with Twin Cities Public Television Minnesota Channel, created a video for statewide broadcast and training use called Stop Sexual Violence, Listen and Lead. I believe a copy of that was distributed to members of the committee. That video received statewide broadcast in April of 2008 as part of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, but it was also used by MnCASA's 70-some member programs around the state to do both professional and local community training on sexual violence prevention. And what came from that work was a commitment to start planning and organizing the Minnesota Sexual Violence Prevention Summit, which Donna will talk about when we reflect upon what happened in 2009. This is where the interpretive dance comes in, Mr. Chair. But in the interest of time, I'm just going to pass over that. A critical thing that happened in 2009, and the image that you see on this screen was going to be a clip that we were going to show you from the Listen and Lead video. But it was very important, we thought, that for the first time in this legislature, sexual violence was talked about not in the Public Safety Committee, but in a hearing and a conversation in the Health Committee. We started to talk about primary prevention as one part of our response to sexual violence. The other important thing about 2009 was a considerable work was done through the year to plan, in December of 2009, Minnesota's Sexual Violence Prevention Summit. Donna's going to talk to you a little bit about the impact of that summit, but one of the things that is important to note was that the leadership making that happen came from Governor Pawlenty's office, but it also brought together five state agencies to co-host the event, a reflection of the fact that responding to sexual violence is something that we have to do in partnership. It's not just a public safety response, it's not just public health, but we needed corrections at the table, as well as other key state partners. But the impact of that conference, and it was significant both in Minnesota and nationally, is something that I'm going to turn over to Donna to describe.
Thank you. The structure of that day was to bring a group of people together, both those who are very familiar with the issue of sexual violence and those for whom this was a new issue, and those people who didn't think they actually had a reason to even need to worry about sexual violence. The concept being that together we could have some provocative conversations about how does this issue affect the bottom line of your business? How does it affect you when you function as a media outlet? How does it show up in your faith community? So our goal was really to not spend the day admiring the problem or learning more about the problem, but really provoking people to find their commitment, their voice, the place where they saw that they could make a difference and have courageous conversations or take courageous action around preventing sexual violence. So the impact of that was really to start to bring, to expand our circle, to bring new leaders in to help us really come together to envision what we could do if we were able to work together. We know that we can't educate or prosecute or treat ourselves out of this problem. It is a bigger problem that needs an entirely different, in addition to those things, it needs also this other approach that really looks at stopping the harm before it happens, not after it happens. So what the summit did for us was it expanded our group of individuals who are ready to champion and to take on sexual violence prevention as a part of their role. We saw leadership developing in these five state departments as well as outreach to other state departments in the administration who are interested in joining in this work.
In 2010, we had two important things happen. It's very important in responding to sexual violence that we deal with it as bystanders, that when we see something that we think is wrong, we step forward and we intervene as individuals. But in 2010, We had an interesting and challenging conversation here in the legislature about what it means for us at a public policy level to step forward as bystanders, to say something is happening that doesn't help, mm-hmm. is not helpful in terms of the sort of environment we have that enables sexual violence. Mincasa advanced the Clean Hotels Bill. In short, what that bill did was said that the state simply is not going to purchase services from hotels that offer pay-per-view pornography. I know that in talking with legislators during that year about pornography, I had to be clear that we were not talking about your grandmother's pornography, that pornography has changed dramatically. In the last 5 years, the fusion of violence and pornography has completely changed the impact that this has on our culture. The Clean Hotels Bill was a good conversation, but not an easy one. But I think the important moment at that, we reflect upon the lead author in the House, Representative Larry Haas, who, when faced with silence in a committee vote on advancing that bill, so the question was yes or no, but the committee vote was silence. It was Representative Haas who stood up and said, this is the problem, that we're not speaking up when we need to. So that was an important conversation for us to have. It was one of the things that came out of the Sexual Violence Prevention Summit. But also during that year, we started conversations engaging Dean Janis, who will be presenting to you later today, to help us look at how do we think about expanding and broadening our response to sexual violence. That's certainly what Dean Janis is going to share with you today, and we'll leave it to him to expand upon what some of those alternatives might look like if we expand our response. In 2011, some things came out of work in 2010 that was done in the legislature. The legislature really was trying to grapple with what I suggest here is the elephant in the room for many of us, and that's the unsustainable cost of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. For us in the sexual violence advocacy community, that cost represents one of the barriers to creating a more diverse and balanced response to sexual violence. I don't have to share with any of the members on this committee the burden and the challenge of unraveling that cost in our budget. But certainly the publication of the Legislative Auditor's Report in 2011, and also a report that came forward from the Department of Human Services looking at options for reducing the cost of sexual violence of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program are important, and I would suggest they're still going to be important tools for the legislature to work with moving forward. One important thing to highlight about that DHS report is that it's one of its significant observations, and an entire section of the report looked at the important role of sexual violence prevention in helping to reduce the overall cost that we experience in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Also in 2011, Mincasa became one of what approximately 15 organizations around the country receiving a targeted grant from the Ms. Foundation to help link sexual violence public policy work focusing on prevention with our interest in also preventing child sexual abuse and exploitation. And I'll turn it over for Donna for a moment to give you a sense of what evolved from that Ms. Foundation work.
For the 2 years that we've been working with the Ms. Foundation cohort of grantees across the United States, we really have honed our focus and our language about childhood sexual abuse. What we understand is that while we have developed a little bit more familiarity with talking about sexual violence when we talk about adolescents, teens, and adults, there is still really broad and deafening silence about childhood sexual abuse. It's one of those topics people do not want to talk about, do not want to know about. Those victims are incredibly silent. And we also know that that is really the place where factors combine to really ensure that and they create a strong sort of sense of risk for somebody, a child becoming either a perpetrator or moving into perpetration behavior. A lot of that really is developed in childhood through childhood, adverse childhood experiences. It also, those experiences can put someone at risk for victimization. So we know that childhood sexual violence and exploitation is really critical, and solving that is critical to solving all sexual violence, perpetration and victimization. We also know that there's a really strong link between childhood sexual abuse and victimization and exploitation with the movement that we are now focusing a lot on, which is trafficking. We know that many of those people who are trafficked leave home and are vulnerable because they are escaping abuse, sexual abuse and physical abuse at home. So the focus on childhood sexual abuse was really new for us, but it became our understanding of the place where we really must start if we want to create prevention of all kinds of perpetration and victimization through sexual violence.
We just have two more slides here, Mr. Chair. Because there are only two years left, but in 2012, Minkasa continued the work started with the Ms. Foundation support and introduced the Demand the Change for Children campaign. And that created an event at the Mall of America that engaged us with the public in a way that we had never been engaged to talk about sexual violence, and really to bring it to families in Minnesota so that they understand it in a way that's relevant to them, that it's part of what they're doing to rear their children and to create safety within their families and their communities. And that event was very successful and was actually going to end up being an annual event in partnership with the Mall of America. But I take you back to our conversation about the cost of sexual violence report and how important it was to get that report and to put that 61,000 figure out into the public and into the policy debate. Both the CDC at the national level and this legislature in 2002 did two very important things. The CDC has started the process of annually reporting an estimate of the prevalence of sexual violence in the United States. Finally, we're going to have a number to look at that tells us really how big, what is the scope of this problem, not from the perspective of reports or hospitalizations or incarcerations, but from the perspective of victims. How many people are really, really being affected by sexual violence in our country? In this legislature, we piggybacked on that effort and passed legislation that now requires the Minnesota Department of Health to do the same thing annually using those CDC estimates broken down by state. So that's one piece of data that we're going to have now on a regular basis. We're going to be able to see the trend as well as understand the annual prevalence of sexual violence in Minnesota. Minkasa also started working with the legislature and more directly with the governor's office seeking an executive order to create a cabinet-level interdepartmental work group to coordinate across disciplines our existing efforts in this state that can have an impact on sexual violence. We know there's not going to be more money to put into sexual violence right now, but there are many things that we are doing in state departments that have an impact, for example, on child development, on child abuse and exploitation. But what we've learned is that the Department of Health is not talking to the Department of Education, the Department of Education is not talking to the Department of Corrections, the Commissioner of Corrections is not necessarily always in conversation with DHS, the state administration is not in conversation with those agencies as well. Each of them, even the higher education university system, has a role, a statutory role, or a programmatic role that has an impact on sexual violence prevention, but it's not coordinated. And that's an effort that we're going to continue a conversation with, both with the governor and in the legislature. Finally, in 2012, we carried on some work that started in 2011, which, as Donna alluded to, was to better understand the emerging research that links child development and child abuse and exploitation with sexual violence and the usefulness of perhaps focusing at least on child development, abuse and exploitation as a starting point to have an impact on sexual violence long term. And finally, as we're looking to the coming year and working with all of you and others in the community, our big questions are, is it finally time to act and create a more balanced response to the harm of sexual violence in Minnesota? Will we let the new data, the emerging prevalence data, but also what research is telling us about some of the root causes of violence, and particularly sexual violence in our culture, become part of shaping our policy decisions? And will we make prevention a primary priority as part of Minnesota's response to sexual violence. And those are questions that we expect we will engage in with each of you, with others in the legislature, and with our community through the coming year.
And I would just add, this issue is an incredibly complex issue when you look at both the impact of victimization on victims, the social context that supports sexual violence or that normalizes sexual violence. We have a lot of work to do, and as Bob rightly said, this impacts so many of the areas of work that you will be doing over the next 2 years with your policy decisions. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, we're available to respond to questions, and I would suggest that members direct them to Donna, because I only know this stuff from a scripted perspective.
We have several questions. We'll start with Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your testimony was that they're going to start collecting new data and putting out more information about victims of sexual violence. If we're not getting the data from reports and from doctors, sexual violence goes tremendously unreported. How are you getting the data, and how are you going to know it's reliable?
Ms. Dunn.
Mr. Chair and members, the data that will be collected, what the Health Department is directed to do is really to take a look at new data that comes to their awareness, compile that and bring it into you to help you understand what we are learning about sexual violence, both the prevention and intervention and incidents. The CDC did start doing an annual data survey called the National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey, and that will be producing yearly data about each individual state. So there will be specific data relevant to Minnesota. We did have 1 year of that data. It is at this point, statisticians tell me that it is at this point 1 year of data is not enough on which to base conclusions. But there were some pretty serious implications about the incidence of sexual violence among Minnesota women and men. Overall, what they say is that we are looking at about a 1 in 5 incidence with women, 1 in 10 with men.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Hillstrom.
Thank you. Just to follow up, so did they, like, ask people in school, or did they ask people that went to the doctor? Or I'm curious as to how it is that we get that information.
Ms. Dunn.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Hillstrom. This was a random digit dial survey that was conducted over several months' time. It was unusual in that, I am told, it was unusual in that it also included cell phone numbers, and so they really had, and I don't have the data in front of me about how many individuals that they connected with, but it is a well-respected research approach to gathering prevalence data from the general public. So it is not based on reports. They did gather information, however, from those people with whom they spoke about the rate, the number of those, the percentage of those who did go forward to report. And it is alarmingly low. Particularly victims of childhood sexual abuse reported a very, very low level.
Mr. Chair, brief response to that.
Mr. Chairsley.
We can get to the committee members the NISFIS report from 2012. Give you a sense of how the data was collected. Mm-hmm. But I also know that it was almost a 10-year process at the CDC developing the data collection procedure so that they could create some reliability in that data.
Thank you. We'll go to Representative Simon, Kiefer, and then Mullery at this point. Representative Simon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And to both of you, thanks a lot for your work. I want to particularly, though, congratulate you for talking about and acting in the area of childhood mm-hmm. sex abuse. Mm-hmm. As you put it, it absolutely is the elephant in the room. And before I get to my question, let me just point out, you know, part of the problem with childhood sex abuse, as you well know, is the layers and layers of shame and embarrassment.
Yes.
That go on top of the inherently violent nature of this exploitation, which causes victims not to come forward in many cases for
Absolutely.
Years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't because they forgot that this happened to mm-hmm. them. It's not a question of repressed memory or anything mm-hmm. like that. It's because of the shame and because of the embarrassment, mm-hmm. aided and abetted by oftentimes the covering up of this kind of abuse in all sorts of contexts. And that's why it sometimes takes years, many, many years, for people who are victims of childhood sex abuse to come forward. And I think that acknowledgement is very important and part of what I assume you're talking about. So my question is, can you quantify the incidence of sexual violence or sexual exploitation against children, those 18 years and under, in Minnesota?
Ms. Dunn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, the NISFIS report, in fact, does inquire of the folks that they have contact with about the incident when their experience with sexual violence started, and not unlike other surveys or other research that has been done, we know that people who identify that they have had an experience with sexual violence, the vast majority of those had their first experience as a child. The rate of early incidents and onset of these is typically very young ages, under the age of 10, and particularly for male victims. That is one area where that is the onset of that abuse really is in early childhood, may often in fact drop off, and not a man may not experience, or adult men may not experience sexual violence at the rate that adult women do, but their experience as childhood victims is really, really significant. So we're talking about, you know, we're talking, I don't have numbers in front of me, but it would be in the range of, you know, we hear national reports suggesting one in five women, many of those experiencing their first experience with sexual violence in childhood, one in 7 to 10 men also, again, experiencing it in early childhood. Again, we would have that data in the NISFIS report that we can send to you.
Well, and Mr.
Representative Simon,
thank you. Just to follow up, I mean, if any good came out of the whole Penn State affair,
yes,
it's a textbook example about how this stuff sometimes can get covered up, and it's a question of some kid, now an adult, coming forward and no one believing this kid because a reputable person or institution or clique within an institution like the football program at Penn State just really sweeps this stuff under the rug. So I'm glad that you're doing what you're doing, because it's something that has to be uncovered and talked about, particularly because of that sort of latency between when the abuse happened and when the person, particularly men, are comfortable even talking about it, much less taking action on it.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, appreciate your work, and I'm carrying your bill again this session, so thank you, Mr. Tracy, for having faith in me, too. 2 years ago in this committee, we had a conversation about, and it wasn't involving you guys, it was a different bill, but it had to do with sanctuary cities. And there was a parade of women coming down to testify against cracking down on the sanctuary city situation in fear of their lives, and they were actually abused women. So this is, there's some problems, I think, with the abuse happening in the illegal immigration communities. And some of this also, maybe not even illegal, could be a cultural thing where women are treated differently than how they are in our culture. And I talked about that in our committee. I don't know how many of you were in there that day. I said that's not the way we treat our women and children in this country. But just wondered on this data, if you can also, like you're saying, to separate the child part of it, can we quantify the perhaps the illegal immigrant piece of it? Because that also is going to segue into your $8 billion cost, because these women and children obviously need help too, and just wondering how that would impact also the cost of this problem.
Ms. Dunn.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiefer, you raise a really good issue, and that is really speaks to sort of the dynamics of child sexual abuse and sexual violence in general, in that those who perpetrate harm in this manner, using sex as a tool of harm, really seek out people who are, they feel as though they can have this contact with, or this they can abuse with impunity. In other words, they look for people who might be not perceived to be strong witnesses. They might have some vulnerability of some sort. And when we talk about the immigrant community, very often violence, domestic violence and sexual violence becomes a tool that can be used against somebody because that person is so reliant on the person perhaps who is abusing her. for home, for all of those things that mean security. That to speak out against that means I may be deported, I may lose my community. So your question really gets to some what we know about the broad dynamics of how sexual violence is perpetrated and who is the target. And it is very often people from communities who are have less power in a lot of ways.
Ms. Dunn, you're not suggesting, I didn't hope and didn't misread the question, that certain cultures are more, that there's more prevalence of being a sexual assault victim than others.
Mr. Chair, no, I'm not suggesting that it is a cultural problem. I am, or with any particular cultural group. What I am saying is that it's a dynamic of sex offenders to actually select people who appear vulnerable and with whom they can do this crime and not be discovered.
Very good.
Mr. Chair.
Anything else? Mr. Tracy? We're going to have to move this along a little bit, but Mr. Tracy.
Yeah, briefly responding to Representative Kiefer's question, I think that we do still need, I don't think that we're going to be able to find comprehensive data in terms of undocumented situations seeking assistance with sexual violence or domestic violence, but we may be able to get some approximating data that gives us a sense of how big that problem is. We certainly don't have that available to us right now, but that's something we can work with you on.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take Representative Mullery, and then we're going to take Representative Uglum, and then we're going to move on. I'm afraid that we could do this hearing, but we have two other guests today. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think mine will be a lot quicker. Ms. Duff, I haven't looked for a couple years. At that time, the state had no money into prevention, which I know that most of the sexual assault groups say is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. We weren't putting a dollar in, and the only money was, I believe, for Patty Wetterling's office, mm-hmm. and that was all federal money. Have we changed and put any money into that, and what's the status of the federal money? Is that going to remain, or what's happening? I haven't checked for a couple of years.
Ms. Dunn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, you are in fact right. There is no additional, there are no state dollars that are directly targeted to sexual violence prevention. That has not changed. The federal money, which is attached to the Violence Against Women Act, has continued to come into the state through the CDC and coming into the Minnesota Department of Health. It has decreased significantly. I think over the last 5 years, it's decreased probably about 20%. So we and again experienced another perhaps temporary cut this year of an additional 20%. We're waiting to see if that will be restored.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. She almost, I think, answered. I was wondering, with the changes in Congress, what they're suggesting cuts, will that probably be cut or not? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I think that is still up in the air until the Violence Against Women Act is passed, and the details of that are ironed out. Thank you.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon referenced the Penn State situation, which, of course, was an absolutely horrible situation. But I was wondering if you have any data and have done any research into childhood sexual violence with other community organizations, and if there's been anything done through those organizations to prevent any further problems.
Ms. Dunn.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we are aware that as a result of the Penn State case, that many other victims have come forward to identify long-term abuse that happened within the context of a school, of other community organizations, of faith communities. So we understand, and I think this gets to back to the spectrum of prevention when we talk about, you know, one of the areas that we all need to be working on collectively is organizational practices and procedures. And that points directly to organizations such as colleges, universities, private schools, faith communities, other community organizations that need to be, as long as they are protecting their organization over protecting children, we will continue to have this problem. So helping them understand the changes that they can make to the way they function as an organization is critical to creating environments where that is just not likely to happen at all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Dunn, Mr. Tracy, for the presentation. Hopefully we'll have you back at some point.
Thank you.
Dean Janis, while Dean Janis is coming up, I need a motion to approve the minutes of January 22nd. Representative Schoen moves that. Any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails. Dean Janis, thank you very much for coming again to short notice to present to the body. So if you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Eric Janis. I'm the president and dean of William Mitchell College of Law, although I'm here, of course, in an individual capacity. Just to give you a full disclosure, I was deeply involved in the litigation 20 years ago, challenging the constitutionality of Minnesota's sex offender commitment program. Representative Dennis Linehan in that. I've finished with that for a number of years and done a lot of study, publication, and writing in this area. So I'm here both as an advocate and as a scholar in this area. Preliminarily, I'd like to say a couple of things, and I'm wondering if you could give me any guidance on time here.
You have approximately a half hour because we want to hear about the civil commitment process in the last 15 minutes.
William Mitchell is sponsoring a conference on February 22nd on institutional failure to protect this very issue that was just being discussed. It's obviously inspired by the Penn State situation, but we are going to have a day-long conference on best practices and institutional change, so everybody would be invited to that. What I'd like to address is the question and urge the committee and the members to focus on the question, how can we prevent the most sexual violence in our state and in our society? And I'd like to echo the plea made by the prior two speakers that we focus on data. We're not at sea when it comes to sexual violence. It's a complex problem. It's not homogeneous. There's not one fix. But we ought to be basing our public policy on the kind of information that, in fact, is available as we work to improve that information in some other ways that have been discussed. I want to start with some basic concepts here and look at an overview of some of the tools that are available for addressing sexual violence. We talk a lot about sex offenders, and what we ought to be clear about is that by what we mean when we're talking about sex offenders is people who are both known and unknown sex offenders. And one of the key points I want to make is that when you're talking about sexual violence, you really are talking about an iceberg. An iceberg, probably 5% of which is clearly visible, and 95% of which is not visible, often invisible. And a key, in my mind, to good policy is making the invisible visible, understanding that most sexual violence is not the highly visible kind of sexual violence that we read about in the newspaper, but it's the kind of sexual violence that is unremarkable, that happens day in and day out in the privacy of people's homes or locked away behind some locked room door. Second of all, I want to talk about the concept of recidivism, because as I'll suggest, this has become a key focus of ours as we attempt to address the serious problem of sexual violence. I don't want to minimize the problem of recidivism, but my key point is that we need to look beyond the problem of recidivism, because recidivism is only a very small part of the problem. What do we mean by recidivism? Recidivism is the repeat offense in a sexual way of someone who has been previously convicted of a sexual crime. There are a number of different ways of measuring it. It's a very, very difficult thing to measure accurately because of the problem of the lack of reporting of sexual violence. We can measure by rearrests, by reconvictions, And the measure of recidivism also depends very definitely on what period of time we're looking at. Are we looking at offense within a one-year period, three-year period, 12-year period, lifetime period? Those all have a bearing on the measure of recidivism. Two other key policies or ideas: the idea of punishment, holding people accountable for misbehavior. Obviously, it's a key tool that we have as a society. We want to express our moral disapproval of sexual violence, and a key way of doing that is through the criminal justice system. That will remain and should remain a key tool. But as well, we should be thinking about prevention and what policies exist to stop sexual violence before it happens. Punishment all obviously assumes that someone has been victimized and hurt. Prevention assumes that we can prevent people from being hurt. They're two separate concepts. They're interrelated. And the Minkasa's presentation suggests that we need to have more of a focus on prevention, more of a balanced focus, and that echoes my thoughts as well. Some basic tools that we have for addressing sexual violence. Very generally, the idea of victim services, of supporting people who've been victimized, of facilitating the reports, of preventing re-victimization of people in the criminal justice and social service system, of ensuring that evidence is appropriately collected and preserved. A second key set of tools is in the criminal justice system. And here we have a range of tools ranging from probation into the community, prison sentences, treatment as a mandated part of a criminal justice sentence, and supervised release in the community. We also have a number of tools that are outside of the criminal justice system that are thought of as civil tools. Community notification when sex offenders are released from confinement, registration of sex offenders, civil commitment to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Mr. Kerwin, I know, is going to talk more about that. I will say that over the past 20 years, because that's how long this program has been in existence, we've seen an ever-growing proportion of our sexual violence dollars in this state go to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. The lack of balance, in my view, in a large way stems from that ever-growing expensive program. I'm not saying that that has no part in our arsenal of tools to deal with sexual violence, but it needs to be a balanced part. I think it's important for the committee to know that there's a class action lawsuit currently pending in federal court addressing the constitutionality of the MSOP. It's a serious lawsuit. It's certified as a class action. And at the direction of the court, the Commissioner of Human Services has appointed a task force that is actively meeting. I'd encourage any members we have four legislators on the task force. It's chaired by former Chief Justice Eric Magnuson. And I would look forward to some very substantive recommendations coming out of that task force about putting the civil commitment system more in balance. Finally, I want to echo the words of Mr. Tracy and Ms. Dunn about a public health approach to sexual violence. It's looking at sexual violence as a problem that is pervasive in our society. What is a public health approach? It's systematic and comprehensive. It doesn't choose one or just a few interventions. It looks comprehensively, and it looks at the interactivity of various interventions. It includes primary prevention. It seeks to address the root causes of sexual violence. And lastly, it involves, as a key part, evaluation and dissemination of best practices. So it acknowledges that we don't know perfectly how to deal with sexual violence, but it very consciously says we are going to learn what's effective and replicate those approaches. So the key question, I think, that we as citizens and as policymakers need to ask is, are we allocating our limited public resources in the most effective manner to prevent the most sexual violence? In my opinion, the answer is no. Why? Because we've been asking the wrong question, and as a result of asking the wrong question, we're focusing only on a small part of the problem. We've been asking mostly about how can we prevent recidivist sexual violence. How can we identify who are the worst people who are likely to reoffend and put them in a very expensive program locked away behind razor wire in Moose Lake or in St. Peter? I want to ask the question and suggest that the data, what the data show us about recidivism, how serious a problem that is. If you read the newspapers, you would think that recidivism is the key problem around sexual violence. Sex offenders are portrayed as almost certain to reoffend, and that if we can simply keep these people who will reoffend locked up longer, we will make a big dent in sexual violence. The truth of the matter is that although recidivism is a problem, it is a much smaller part of the problem than we might be led to think. I want to focus on two studies that have been done, the Department of Justice study following about 10,000 offenders, sex offenders in 15 states released in 1994. They did a 3-year follow-up. And here's what they found. Almost 95% of the sex offenders released in this study were not rearrested for a new sex crime within 3 years. Recidivism rate for new sex crime during that period was about 5%. Among child molesters, the recidivism rate, again, for rearrest, was about 3%. Now, we have to take these numbers in context. We know that much sexual violence is not reported, so these figures are no doubt underestimates. But these are the people who have come to the attention of authorities and rearrested for a new sex crime. Sex offenders have a same crime reoffense rate that's among the lowest of all criminals. So if you compare sex offenders to burglars, to assaulters, those other criminals have higher rates of same crime reoffense. Sex offenders have an any crime reoffense rate that's among the lowest of all criminals. Again, this is the DOJ study. Now, sex offenders were 4 times more likely to be rearrested for a new sex crime than were non-sex offenders who were released from prison. However, when you look at the results of this study and examine all of the sex crimes committed by released prisoners, sex offenders only constituted 13% of the new sex crimes that were committed. In other words, most of the sex crimes that were committed in this study were committed by individuals who had not been convicted of a sex crime before. And I'm happy to take questions along the way or wait, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you complete your presentation, okay. And then we'll see. Maybe how long do you have left?
Probably 10 minutes.
Okay, because if we're going to ask questions, it's not going to we'll just have to move along here a little
okay.
bit. So,
okay. All right. Well, let me just move along a little faster then. My point is the recidivist crime is a small part of the problem. Most of the people that are in prison for sex crimes were not sex offenders before they were caught for this crime. The criminal history of sex offenders in prison shows that most of those people have no prior violent offense. Now, what's my point about this? my point is that if you focus on recidivism and recidivist violence, you are missing most of the sexual violence that takes place in our community. Most of the recidivists are not committed to MSOP. Most of the recidivists who are in prison for sex crimes are going to be released into the community. We can focus on the stream of sexual violence. And all the way on the left-hand side of your screen, the highest bar would represent the 61,000 incidents of sexual violence that Ms. Dunn referred to. Only a fraction of those crimes are reported. Only a fraction of those crimes are cleared by police. Only a fraction get into prison. That means that only a fraction of the and only a fraction of those people in prison are recidivists. So when we focus on recidivist crime, we are missing and ignoring most of the sexual violence in our community. If we're serious about addressing sexual violence, we will have a balanced approach. We will not ignore recidivism, but we will not assume that that is the only or the biggest problem that we have to address. Right now, as has been mentioned, we spend a hugely disproportionate amount of our sexual violence prevention dollars on a small portion of people whom we identify as the most dangerous. That's another way of saying that we spend most of our dollars on a portion of the recidivists rather than on the broader problem of sexual violence in the community.
Very good. Well, Representative Hillstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions about the data. So when you are talking about offenders who recidivate, are you including sex offenders who are charged with the crime of failure to register or violations of that registration requirement, or are you just talking about offenders who have been convicted of a new sex crime?
Dean Janis.
Representative Hillstrom, Mr. Chair, I don't know what the numbers are in that particular DOJ study. They are clearly focusing on sex-related reoffense and rearrest. I don't know whether they included the failure to register crime in those.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then in the data about the number of folks who are civilly committed, does anybody have data on who exactly those folks are and how many crimes they've committed? How many, you know, just because you committed one or have been convicted of one act doesn't mean that you didn't have multiple charges or multiple victims or multiple something. And so is there anywhere that data exists to see who actually is civilly committed?
Representative Hillstrom, Mr. Chair, there is some data on that. The Office of Legislative Auditor, that report contains some data. I published a report about 10 years ago, also looking at the 100 or so people who had been committed up to that date. We know that committed individuals are, on average, they have a greater number of prior offenses than the average sex offender who's being released from prison. But also there's quite a wide range among the committed individuals. So while the average is higher, you have a distribution among those committed individuals. So, for example, we have about 50 people who are currently committed out of the 650 who have no adult offenses on their record. That's because they were committed immediately upon graduating from the juvenile system. There's a fairly high percent, I think about 50% of the individuals who are committed who have two or fewer felony convictions. Fairly high percent who have no first-degree felony convictions among those who are committed. So again, you have a range from the very worst, the people with multiple offenses, down to people with actually very few offenses in the commitment group.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up.
Representative Hillstrom.
Did you say that you did a report? Could we have a copy?
Dean Janis.
Representative Hillstrom and Mr. Chair, absolutely. And I will also say, and I don't mean to be self-promoting, that I wrote a book on this in 2006. I'm happy to provide a complimentary copy to any members of the committee who
would like to have a copy, and I'll send it along.
Ian, were you on the task force?
I am, Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean Janis, I think part of the problem that I have is along the same lines of data, because it seems like the conversation that we get into around this table is the level of the sexual offender. Because if you look at the data, if we put away the worst of the worst, if we've committed them, then how do we know the rate of reoffense? We don't know the recidivism rate of those people. So so it seems like we get to a level that, and certainly not discounting the need for prevention and education, absolutely, but it seems like we have this break point of the worst and all the rest. So how do we navigate through that data?
Representative Kelly,
Dean Janis.
Chair, I think that's an excellent question. We have a system right now that is an all or nothing system in this sense, that when people are released from prison, sex offenders are released from prison, a number of them have some supervised release time where they're supervised, and one of the things we've learned over the years is that intensive community supervision with treatment is an effective means of reducing recidivism. Once that supervised release time ends, though, those people are without any supervision. The only other option that we have available right now is MSOP. And you might say that that's the Cadillac of, that's the most expensive, most restrictive intervention that we have. One of the things that it's clear that we're missing is a range of interventions. A key principle is the risk principle, and that is that you ought to calibrate the intervention to the level of risk. Right now we have one intervention, it's the 100% solution. Not everybody is 100%, just needs that. We ought to have a variety of interventions available.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dean Janis, are we confident that we can measure that so that we know where that level is?
Dean Janis.
Representative Kelly and Mr. Chair, the science is improving, but it's imperfect on risk assessment. We are better at it now than we were 15 or 20 years ago. It's good enough, I think, to inform the management of sex offenders. In other words, we have good enough tools so that we can understand and calibrate what level of intervention is probably appropriate. Is it perfect? Absolutely not.
Yeah. Representative Cornish, then we're going to move on. I just want to ask in the audience, is there anyone who wants to testify? I see Mr. Kaplan is here, who is a treatment provider. Just so we can maybe carve out a couple of minutes. Is there anybody in the audience? Did you want to testify, Mr. Kaplan, or no? Not right now, but towards the end.
If there's some questions about treatment, I'm also on the civil task force. I'd be willing to answer questions.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Representative Cornish.
Oh, Dean Janis, you know I know each other. We were at the same seminar, and you know I put a lot of work into this, and I think I can make a prediction that you aren't going to have any luck with the media on downplaying these cases any more than we do with them beating up on the gun cases. And so realizing that's still going to continue and highlight these and scare everybody, and also realizing that after all the work that I went to and put it into that bill, the county attorneys gave us kudos for working on it, but really walked away from it. The judiciary didn't want it. We had a huge fiscal note, and when I approached the body, really couldn't find any votes who were really interested in releasing sex offenders into halfway houses. So realizing that the media is going to stay the same, we probably can't jerk the votes out to put people into halfway houses and treatment back in the community. Should we think about locking them up and going towards that house file, whatever it was we introduced, where it doubled the sentences, and give the treatment in the correctional institutions rather than the SOP? What's your opinion, just overall, on that?
Good question. Dean Janis.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Mr. Chair, I think it's an excellent question. I do think that the honest and appropriate response to sexual violence is a serious response in the criminal justice system that provides supervision, not only provides punishment, but provides accountability and supervision. The research suggests that long-term supervision and accountability is appropriate in many cases. So I think there are many problems with an indeterminate sentencing structure. I think we have to be careful about calibrating this appropriately. But in my view, the criminal justice system is a key site for dealing with sexual violence. Now, the unfortunate part is that we have this legacy program, MSOP. And, you know, I went back and I looked. In 1994, the legislative auditor said, don't worry, we're increasing criminal sentences, and so in a few years, we will no longer have a need for MSOP. And we know how wrong that prediction has been. So I don't think that increasing sentences will be is the answer to dealing with this huge albatross that we have right now in MSOP. And on the question of the media, I think it's a serious issue. I take some solace in looking at the editorial stance of the Star Tribune recently, which has, I believe, been much more accommodating and welcoming of a more balanced approach than perhaps they have been in the past.
Thank you, Dean Janis, for your presentation. Mr. Kerwin?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question for him. It's for you.
Representative Shaw?
This obviously is a topic we're going to spend quite a bit more time on, and including, is that a committee that they're working on? Under our purview?
That's a good question. I'm not sure when the task force is actually releasing their recommendations to the legislature. Dean, do you know? Because you said it was ongoing, and is it something that we're going to deal with this legislative session? Or
I believe so, Mr. Chair, yes. The task force has already released one mm-hmm. preliminary set of recommendations, and we are meeting three times right now to try to coordinate with the legislature, and we do have four members of the legislature on the task force.
Right, so DHS would be heard there, but it would obviously come here at some point, so I guess we'll have an opportunity to get into this in much more detail. Thank you, Dean.
Good.
Now let's see if we can understand in 15 minutes how people get to MSOP. Assistant Hennepin County Attorney John Kerwin is with us. Thank you very much. Is your slide presentation up? Or
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get it up.
Can somebody help him get that system up there? There we go.
Sorry, I think we've got it. Thank you.
Could you just introduce yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is John Kerwin. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I've been involved for coming up on 20 years some measure with the civil commitment of sexually dangerous persons, first with the Attorney General's office, and in more recent years at Hennepin County. And I've been involved both in doing some of these civil commitment cases, a little bit of involvement with the release cases involving persons who are committed, and then involvement in a number of the cases involving the constitutionality of these statutes. And I'm going to give you a very brief overview of what this civil commitment statute and program is about. I tried to make it 10 minutes long, but I'm happy to answer then any questions. I tried to make it 10 minutes long, but I'm happy to answer then any questions you might have. I thought I would start, though, by talking first about, for those of you who wouldn't have involvement in this, what is civil commitment at all? Not talking about sex offenders, but what is civil commitment? And most of us are more familiar with civil commitment in other contexts, like people have problems with mental illness and chemical dependency, so they have a disorder. And because of that, they present a risk of harm to themselves or others. And so the state intervenes through a judicial process to require that the person remain in a treatment program for a period of time and then be under court supervision and receiving treatment. So that's what civil commitment is about. We have two categories of civil commitment, though, in Minnesota that deal with committing people who are sexually dangerous. We have a statute that was enacted in 1939 called the Psychopathic Personality Statute. We now call it the PP or the SPP, Sexual Psychopathic Personality Statute. We have a second statute, the Sexually Dangerous Person Law, that was enacted in the Sexually Dangerous Person Statute, enacted in 1994. And why do we have statutes like this and commitments like this? Well, when the law was enacted in 1939, Minnesota and a number of states around the country at that time enacted similar laws, and they were intended to deal more with minor sex offenses, and they were used as alternatives to criminal prosecution for people who were low-level sex offenders. The thought was, instead, these people are sick, let's provide them treatment rather than criminally prosecuting them. The 1939 law fell somewhat into disuse over the years. It was used in only a very few cases in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It became to be used only for the very few most serious sex offenders, people who would be criminally prosecuted and probably at the same time also civilly committed. The modern use of civil commitment of sexually dangerous persons in Minnesota began in the early 1990s, and then arose out of a situation that began in the late 1980s. In the late 1980s, there were a few very notorious serious sex offenses, rapes and murders, committed by people who'd recently been released from prison. And Minnesota had gone, I think in the early 1970s perhaps, to early 1980s, to a system of determinate sentences, so people would serve relatively short but fixed periods of time. If they behaved in prison, they would be released two-thirds of the way through their sentence. So people were reaching a date when, by law, they had to be released, even if they were thought to still be very dangerous. And there was a task force convened by Attorney General Skip Humphrey back in about 1988, I think, dealing with issues of sexual violence. And one of the recommendations that came out of that task force was to increase the use of this old psychopathic personality law, and to use it with respect to persons who were being released from prison but who were assessed to still be very sexually dangerous. In 1991, Commissioner of Corrections Frank Wood began a program of DOC reviewing sex offenders who were being released from prison in a systematic way, attempting to determine which of those may be candidates for civil commitment and referring those persons to county attorney's offices to consider possible civil commitment. And the legislature then enacted that screening process into law in 1992. That screening process is still in the statute, and it continues to be used. The Department of Corrections screens sex offenders who are being released from prison. It refers the ones it thinks fall into the category of possible people being to be committed to the county attorneys. County attorneys also get some cases from other places, like parole officers or police might refer a particular case to a county attorney's office. But most cases involve people who are being released from prison and at the end of their fixed prison sentence are determined to still be likely to sexually reoffend. When a county attorney gets a case like that, they review it. Sometimes they retain psychologists to help them review the case, particularly if the issue boils down to how likely is it that this person will reoffend. And then the county attorney decides whether to file the petition in court. If the petition is filed in court, it's filed in the district court, the patient is provided an attorney, the court appoints one examiner who's a psychologist or psychiatrist, usually a psychologist, who specializes in doing these kinds of assessments. The proposed patient, the respondent in the case, can ask the court to appoint a second examiner whom the respondent selects. And so almost always in these cases, there are two court-appointed examiners. And the trial is to the judge, so these aren't jury cases, they're trials to the court. want to talk very briefly about what the elements of the commitment statutes are. And the two statutes are that we have in Minnesota are similar in their elements, and I described the elements here only in a very general way. One is that the person has to have a history of seriously harmful sexual acts. Picking up on Professor Janice's comments and some of the earlier questions, the actual language of the statutes, one of them says habitual course and the other says course. And so it has to certainly be more than a single instance. And the great majority of the people who are committed under the statute are people who would be recidivists under Professor Janice's definition of that, or a definition kind of close to it. They're people who have sexually offended. There's been some kind of intervention that one would hope would stop most people from reoffending, but this person continues to reoffend after an intervention. Mr. Chair, I see there's a question.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there case law that really defines what that history of serious harmful sexual acts are, so it's pretty clear, or there's a clear line, or is it really kind of mushy?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, it's clear in a couple of senses. It's clear that there has to be more than a single instance. There has to be a course of the conduct rather than a single instance of conduct. And there's a case from the Minnesota Supreme Court that Mr. Janice was involved in where the court said that what you need is conduct that creates a likelihood of serious physical or emotional harm. So it has to be, it can't be minimal sexual harm such as touching. I don't want to minimize that too much, but this has to be harm that's on the more serious end of the spectrum. And then there's quite a lot of case law that talk more specifically about the seriousness part. And so there is the intention there to limit the application of the statute to people who are repeat offenders and to conduct that's serious. The statute also requires that there be a mental disorder, and that mental disorder impair the person's ability to control their sexual behavior. And there's case law, in fact, that impairment of ability to control comes from case law. So that's a required part of the commitment. There's also, the statute says that the person has to be likely to engage in future harmful sexual conduct. The Minnesota Supreme Court has put a gloss on that and said that the person has to be highly likely, so that a more likely than not standard isn't a high enough standard. Highly likely is a standard that's higher than that. There have been constitutional challenges to these statutes, and the statutes in each case have been upheld. In Minnesota, we have the Blodgett and the Linehan cases in the 1990s that upheld the constitutionality of these statutes. In the U.S. Supreme Court in the recent era, there are two cases, both of them coming out of Kansas, upholding the constitutionality of civilly committing people who are sexually dangerous. I include here a short quote from the Hendricks case from 1997 from the U.S. Supreme Court, where they recite the state's purpose of the overriding concern being the continued segregation of sexually violent offenders, and that's coupled with the state's ancillary goal of providing treatments to offenders if that's possible. So the court has recognized that the primary purpose of statutes like this is protection of the public, and that providing treatment then is an ancillary goal. I want to talk briefly, because I think this is important for legislators, about then what are some of the constitutional limitations that apply to these kinds of commitments. One is that the past behavior and the likely future behavior has to involve this seriously harmful conduct, not just any sexually harmful conduct, but very seriously harmful conduct. The mental disorders I mentioned has to result in serious difficulty in controlling behavior. And commitment must be programmed to provide treatment. You can still commit someone even if an individual isn't amenable to treatment, but the state has to offer treatment. Part of the thinking here is that if we're going to take away someone's freedom, not to punish them because their punishment is completed, we have to provide them the means as best we can for them to limit the terms of their confinement and to obtain their liberty, and the way you do that is providing treatment. It's clear that confinement can't be done in a punitive manner. that might seem like an odd statement, because to the person who's confined, being confined necessarily feels punitive. But the point here is you can't do things to be punitive. You can humanely confine the person for the protection of the public and then serve your ancillary purpose of providing treatment, but you can't do things to punish. Some of the recent big issues have been mentioned. There was a spike in commitments following 2003, the Grushodin Rodriguez situation. I think at that time there were fewer than 200 people committed. There now are about 670 committed. Another issue has been the lack of releases in the last 20 years. Only two people have been provisionally released from the program. And then as Professor Janis mentioned, there's currently litigation concerning the adequacy of treatment at MSOP. So in terms of the, aside from the legislature, the other forums where these kinds of issues are being considered are, first of all, the 2011 Legislative Auditor's Report, which members of the committee will have, the pending federal class action against MSOP and the Department of Human Services, and the Sex Offender Civil Commitment Task Force. That's been a very quick description. I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. It was very, very concise and very, very important for us to hear that. Mr. Kaplan, do you have anything you want to add real quickly? And then Representative Cornish has a question. If you don't, we can take it. I think we need to spend another committee hearing on this at some point before we actually hear any bill. Okay, very good. Representative Cornish, thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, sir, just for clarification, the only constitutional challenge we have to be worried about is the civil commitment process, correct? In other words, if we put somebody in for 6 years, minimum mandatory for a serious sex crime, and then intensive supervision after the release with leg bracelet or whatever, that's not the constitutional challenge, right? I mean, there's no constitutional challenge on that type of...
Mr. Kerwin.
If we got rid of the, excuse me, I'm sorry, if we didn't civilly commit, the constitutional challenge is, you're talking about, is aimed at civil commitment, not the incarceration and corrections, right?
Mr. Kerwin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, that's certainly correct concerning the current constitutional challenge, and I think many people who are critical or skeptical of constitutionally of the use of civil commitment are more comfortable with the idea of using increased criminal sentences and indeterminate sentences and so on as an appropriate way to deal with this part of the problem. I think, as people have mentioned, it's not necessarily the solution right now, but it may well be part of the solution in the longer term that you have to start at some point, like right now.
Thank you.
Mr. Kerwin, probably have you back at some point. Mr. Kaplan, are we going to have a whole day on treatment, both sex offender treatment at MSOP and also at the Department of Corrections? So maybe that would be a time when we could have you present and you'd be prepared. Okay, members, thank you very much. Meeting's adjourned.